It's a real pleasure to be down here. I have been told before I'm all wet. It is appropriate today. Looked like just right as we got off the exit on the way here, the clouds opened up and got a little drenching. But that's coming from up in Dallas. We're jealous. We've had a pretty good summer overall, but we're still in a real drought situation. We can only water every couple or 3 weeks, only certain hours. So you're starting to see things brown up pretty good. But it's always nice to be able to see some nice rain. I did want to mention right off the bat, I have the privilege of being able to be part of the writing team, the staff that writes for Discern Magazine. And I just wanted to initially mention and ask for your prayers. We had another editorial meeting just recently as we were planning for the November and December schedule and issue, as well as early planning for the January-February issue. We actually have to plan that far in advance, anywhere from 4 to 6 months in advance, which makes it a little bit interesting trying to plan something with regard to current news, world news, events, make it topical. So I do ask for your prayers. We have a very small staff. It's 3, 4, maybe 5 people that are putting out most of that magazine. Several people that are not involved in the full-time work, and those that are involved in the full-time work have multiple jobs, whether it's Life Open Truth, whether it's writing booklets, whether it's doing other things, full-time ministry, administration. So we definitely need your prayers, your help for the direction of the magazine, the writing, the writers, to provide more writers, and that the overall magazine makes an impact. It's not there to just sit there. The whole goal is to be able to make an impact in people's lives. So if you will, please pray for that. I would like to today to cover a small Old Testament passage that some Bible experts have considered a difficult passage, while others have considered it cruel, sad, or even merciless. A merciless section of the Bible, they say. Turn over to the 10th chapter of Leviticus. 10th chapter of Leviticus, and since we know that we are to learn from examples that were given to us by the children of Israel, and that God's judgments should serve as instructions for us, we're going to go ahead and take a look at the account of Nadab and Abihu, and what we can learn from their very serious mistake, and how it impacts our spiritual lives. Now, stepping back a little bit before we get to chapter 10, of Leviticus. In the previous two chapters, we've actually had a lot go on. Aaron had been anointed as the high priest, and his sons dedicated as priests. And you can see that in throughout chapter 8, verses 1 through 36. And their dedication ceremony lasted a full 7 days. It was no short little one single service. It was 7 days. And on the 8th day, they offered sacrifices for the people. And you see that throughout Leviticus 9. And constantly you see Aaron and his sons. Obviously, it also kind of implies a closeness that Aaron had with his sons. That term, Aaron and his sons, is mentioned 10 times, implying a closeness there. In Leviticus 9, 23 and verse 24, we'll start there. Leviticus 9, 23, 24, it says, "And Moses and Aaron went into the tabernacle of meeting and came out and blessed the people." So this is being done in front of the entire congregation. "Then the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people, and fire came out from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the fat on the burnt offering and from the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces." An amazing event. Fire coming from the sky, lighting in probably spectacular fashion the sacrifice. Would have been just an amazing event to be able to remember years later. So with a tremendous and powerful ceremony, we see that God miraculously igniting the offering, and the priests of God, Aaron and his sons, had just been consecrated. Then we start in chapter 10, verse 1. Let's read through the first 8 verses. And mind you, this is after 7 days. This is on the 8th day. That same day everything else happened. Then Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, each took his censer and put fire in it, put incense on it, and offered profane fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. So fire went out from the Lord and devoured them, and they died before the Lord. And Moses said to Aaron, "This is what the Lord spake, saying, by those who come near me, I must be regarded as holy, and before all the people, I must be glorified." So Aaron held his peace. And Moses called Mishael and Elzaphan, the sons of Uziel, the uncle of Aaron, and said to them, "Come near, carry your brethren from before the sanctuary out of the camp." And so they went near and carried them by their tunics out of the camp, as Moses had said. And Moses said to Aaron and Eleazar and Ithamar, his sons, "Do not uncover your heads, nor tear your clothes, lest you die and wrath come upon all the people. But let your brethren, the whole house of Israel, bewail the burning which the Lord has kindled. You shall not go out from the door of the tabernacle of the meeting, lest you die, for all the anointing of oil of the Lord is upon you." And they did according to the word of Moses. Now, if this account had happened today and had been captured on camera, it would be thought of in our human understanding as overly harsh. Such an event would lead off the news with commentators stating how cruel God was and how senselessly he snuffed out the lives of two men who were just trying to serve him. Well, let's dive a little bit deeper, examine a bit more closely, and we'll see why God did what he did, why it was vital to do what he did, and actually it was a merciful lesson that we can learn from. First, we need to know exactly who these men were when it speaks of Nadab and Abihu. The Bible doesn't say a whole lot about these men, but what it does say proves to be rather interesting. Now, when we first look at their background, we understand the takeaway from this section is. We understand it. Because, as we know in the church now, as it refers to in Luke 12, verse 48, "For everyone to whom much is given, from him much will be required." Much is given, much is required. So if you look at Exodus 6, verse 23, so you step back to the previous book of the law, Exodus 6, 23, it says, "Aaron married Elisheba, daughter of Amminadab and sister of Nashon, and she bore him Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar, the four sons of Aaron." So we learn that Nadab and Abihu are the sons of Aaron, the brother of Moses. And they have two other brothers, Eleazar and Ithamar. Now, their names are rather interesting. Nadab's means of one's free will or liberal. Some actually say noble, possibly too, but probably liberal. Abihu's name actually means "that's my father." That's my father. Now, obviously, there's a bigger picture. I think it's rather interesting. Probably they saw at some point people asking Nadab, are you Aaron's son, Nadab? And he was like, "Yeah, that's my father. That's my father." So what did they do? The next kid, they just said, "You know, let's just skip right to the chase. We're just going to name him 'That's my father.'" It's probably she's not the only PK that's ever had that happen. So that's his name. "That's my father." Now, Nadab and Abihu were likely born into slavery. The first mention of them is located smack dab in the middle of the story of Moses coming before Pharaoh of Egypt to communicate God's command to let his people go. So we can assume that Nadab and Abihu were very experienced with the discomfort and pain of slavery and what had happened in Egypt. And we also learned from Numbers 3, verse 2, no need to turn there, that Nadab is the firstborn, he's mentioned first, and Abihu the secondborn. Aside from that, we don't know anything about how old they are or their differences in age. However, due to the fact that every time that they're mentioned in the Bible, they're mentioned together, we can assume that they're probably fairly close in age, probably between 30 and 50 years old, according to some commentators, because we know that Aaron was Moses' elder brother. We know that Moses was 80 years old at the beginning of the Exodus. So just doing some basic math, we can figure they weren't young children, that's for sure. They were men, and they should have been responsible. Now, Nadab and Abihu were PKs. They were PKs. Not preacher's kids. They were priest's kids. And because they were Aaron's sons, they were the first PKs. Okay? I imagine that the knowledge that they had was rather remarkable. If you can, try and put yourself in their shoes. What would they have heard around, called the dining room table, or walks with their father? They would have heard everything being said between Moses and Aaron. They would have heard Moses talking about his discussions and conversations with God. They would have heard Aunt Miriam talking about what happened when she put, you know, her little brother into the bulrushes to hide him from being slaughtered. They would have heard incredible things. They would have seen incredible things. And as such, the entire congregation of Israel would have known them. They would have been through a lot, both good and bad. They would have seen the miracles, but also seen, and perhaps to some degree been involved with, their father's weak leadership when a golden calf was built. They would have been near. They would have seen that. They would have known what God's reaction was to that. And not only that, everyone throughout Israel would have known of them. They were not unknown. So everyone was watching them. We always talk about, I know it, sometimes you'll mention the name Prince George, and you'll see people kind of sparkle like, oh, I seen that little baby, the pictures of that little Prince George. Just like years and decades ago, many of us saw Prince William being born and watched him grow up. People saw these young men grow up. They were princes of Israel, if you want to call it that. Now, the next mention of Nadab and Abihu is found in Exodus 24, verse 1. Then he said to Moses, come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. You are to worship at a distance. The Israelites are camped at Mount Sinai, and God tells Moses to come up to the mountain here. Notice here that Nadab and Abihu are included on a very short list that is privileged to attend Moses. We're talking about 2.5 million people leaving Egypt, and they're two of a group of 70 that's privileged to be able to attend to Moses. Then we see how Nadab and Abihu were among another even smaller group for a tremendous honor. Later in that same chapter of Exodus 24 and verse 9 through 11, verse 9 says, Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel went up and saw the God of Israel. And under his feet was something like the pavement of sapphire, clear as the sky itself. But God did not raise his hand against these leaders of Israelites. They saw God, and they ate and they drank. They actually were in the presence of God. Very few, very rare, very special, incredibly memorable. Surely this is an honor that Nadab and Abihu would easily not forget for the rest of their lives. A short time later, Moses records in Exodus 28, first five verses, that God's plan to institute his priesthood through Aaron and his sons. It says, have Aaron, your brother, brought to you from among the Israelites, along with his sons, Nadab and Abihu. God had plans for them. Eleazar and Ithamar, so that they may serve me as priests. What an awesome opportunity to be able to serve God. Have your name put in his word for centuries, millennia for people to read. Verse 2, make sacred garments for your brother Aaron and get to give him the dignity and honor. They had special garments made for them as well. They were to be held out as special. So Nadab and Abihu have quite a history of not only hearing of, but seeing the miracles of God, from the deliverance of the Israelites to the slavery in Egypt, and the crossing of the Red Sea to the destruction of Pharaoh's army. They not only witnessed the tremendous power and majesty of God, both on Mount Sinai as well as through the travels, but they were well aware of the Ten Commandments being given. Nadab and Abihu also had the tremendous honor of being in God's presence. Then they had the opportunity to know that they were blessed by being God's chosen priests, chosen and directly spoken of by God. Surely Nadab and Abihu appear to have been very special, a very privileged calling, privileged training. Well, that puts a new light on Nadab and Abihu. They're not just a couple of guys who made an easy mistake. They were witnesses to numerous miracles, God's presence, and called and spoken of directly by God. A lot would be expected of them because a lot had been given to them. Unfortunately, they probably reverted back to some of the things they'd seen in Egypt before, where the high priest could do whatever they wanted, and there probably were not very stringent rules and standards for everything associated with those pagan gods. And so with many other Israelites at that time, they came into God's presence with neither majestic reverence nor with fear. They simply did not grasp the relevance, the difference between an infinite, all-powerful God of all creation and the old gods, fake gods of Egyptian idolatry, where drinking, music, processions, even nakedness was welcomed to feed or entertain the old gods. They didn't understand the difference fully. So what is our takeaway from that? We've been given knowledge that Nadab and Abihu did not have. We've been given more full picture of God's plan. And we've been given God's Holy Spirit. We can go before God at any time in prayer, and we actually have the opportunity to be able to read those words in front of us, lying on our laps right now, or on the laptops. The examples. How much more is expected of us? And for young people, same thing. This applies to you as well. In the coming days, weeks, we'll be traveling to the feasts. None of the school friends will be traveling there. We'll get the opportunity and the privilege of learning and getting to know more about God's way for 8 days. Very similar to Nadab and Abihu. And how will we be at the end of those 8 days? Will we take it carelessly, or will we move forward in the right way? Just as a lot was expected of Nadab and Abihu, a lot is expected of us. Now, one major reason that God decided to strike down Nadab and Abihu was that they failed to discern. They failed to discern. The job of the priesthood had many responsibilities, but among the most vital was the job of teaching through example, as well as verbalizing how God separated things, people, or times for special purposes. In the book, Raising Up a Faithful Priest, Raising Up a Faithful Priest by Richard Nelson, he puts it this way. Priests were boundary setters in the sense that they defined and separated categories and taught these distinctions to the people. Priests were boundary setters. Do you and I consider ourselves to be boundary setters? Because we should. If you look at Leviticus 10, verse 10, just after this incident has happened, it says, you must distinguish between holy and unholy, between clean and unclean. And that's what discerning is. When you look up discerning, it's like weighing something in the balance, like scales. Truth, holiness versus uncleanness. Doesn't say that you're pronouncing the punishments, but you're judging. You're making distinguishment, discerning. Ezekiel 44:23 talks about this once again. Ezekiel 44:23, talking to the priests. And they shall teach my people the difference between the holy and the unholy, and cause them to discern between the unclean and the clean. Cause them to discern. See the difference. The priest was supposed to discern and teach discernment between the common and the holy things, between the sacred and the profane, between truth and error, godliness from corruption, godly worship from superstition and heathen rites. But here we see Nadab and Abihu, less than 24 hours after this ceremony has happened, after the installation of the priesthood, they showed they couldn't fully grasp the concept, much less teach it. And you can't teach something if you're not doing it. It was a poor start to the priesthood, but one that would be repeated as often as we read through the books of the prophets. If you look back earlier in Ezekiel 22, verse 26, here we see, it says, her priests have violated my law and profaned my holy things. They have not distinguished between the holy and the unholy, nor have they made known the difference between the clean, unclean, and the clean, I should say. And they have hidden their eyes from my Sabbaths, so that I am profaned among them. This is something the God of Israel had a real problem with the religious leaders. They couldn't discern, they couldn't distinguish. And so how could the people do it without that? We see that in Micah 3, verse 9 through 11. It says, the priests taught for pay, and the prophets divined for money. It was a job. That's all it was. It was about ways to make money. It had nothing to do with teaching God's way. If you'll turn to Malachi 2, verse 6. Malachi 2, verse, starting verse 6 and going through verse 9, it says, the law of truth was in his mouth, and in justice, excuse me, and in justice was not found on his lips, nor he walked with me in peace and equity and turned many away from iniquity. For the lips of a priest should keep knowledge, and people should seek the law from his mouth. For he's the messenger of the Lord of hosts. But you have departed from the way. You have caused many to stumble at the law. You have corrupted the covenant of Levi, says the Lord of hosts. Therefore, I also have made you contemptible and base before all the people, because you have not kept my ways, but have shown partiality in the law. Those that should have been leaders, those that should have been teaching God's way, didn't. They went the opposite way. When we look at religious leaders today, that's exactly what's happening with the modern-day descendants of the children of Israel. The same exact things. If we look, just for instance, at the leaders, the religious leaders in Great Britain, we see a number of different things, because they had a recent decision that was reached where they decided to ordain women, not just as priests, they've already done that, they decided to ordain women to the role of bishops. In fact, there was an interesting picture that they showed. They had a couple women, and they were drinking some champagne. Of course, they had kind of the dog collar on, showing that they were serving the priesthood. And they had a big sign next to them, and it said, a woman's role is in the house, ... of bishops. That's what they wanted. They wanted something different, not what God said. But that's not surprising. Oh, thank you very much.
What's wrong with that?
Thank you. They wanted something different. They wanted more. They haven't been able to discern or differentiate right from wrong. But that's not something new. This has been happening in Great Britain for some decades. Decades ago, the Archbishop of Canterbury, the leader of the Church of England, said that there's no such thing as revealed truth. The leader of the church there said there's no such thing as revealed church. Another prominent bishop called the resurrection a conjuring trick with old bones. Blasphemous. Other bishops received standing ovations at church conferences by calling the Bible a cultic idol, and that Christians should pray to God the Mother. This isn't just the man on the street. These are the religious leaders saying these things. Church of England has also issued silly formal apologies to Charles Darwin, since they now admit he was right about everything with regards to his theories. They've also issued apologies to the entire third world for spreading Christianity. Apologizing for everything. In 2013, they eliminated the ban on gay priests, and they now bless gay marriage. In fact, the Episcopal Church, which is under the Anglican Church, it's the American version of the Anglican Church, Episcopal Church now allows and even encourages transgender priests. Encourages it. So much for setting boundaries. The religious leaders today prefer, with their complete lack of discernment, they prefer and actually do their very best to remove all boundaries. Now, another lesson we can take away from this message is that man's ways are not God's ways. Man's ways are not God's ways. The first verse says that Nadab and Abihu were offering profane fire, or some translations use the term strange fire. It means foreign, unusual, not belonging to God. Back in chapters 8 and 9, the offering had been consumed by a fire that was so impressive, a display of power, that the people fell forward in awe. It was a fire that was considered God's holy fire, and Moses and Aaron were told very clearly, and given specific instructions in chapter 6, verse 10 through 13, of how to deal with it, that his son should never allow the fire to die. And upon that fire, the sacrifices were made, and from that fire started God's coals would be taken twice a day and put into a censer. And a censer, if you want to picture it, would be like a dustpan, a larger metal with a covering. They would be put into the censer. And a very fine, expensive incense would be sprinkled on top at the golden altar of the holy place. And this incense later, figurative, our prayers would go up to God's nostrils as a sweet-smelling smoke. Now, Aaron's sons had received all the proper instructions. They were warned by Moses time and time again, we see in Leviticus 8:35, to do exactly as they were told, or they would have to pay with their lives. Well, there's about a dozen speculations about what specifically Nadab and Abihu did by offering strange fire. Commentaries state that it may have been to add an extra uncalled for offering. It may have been to offer at the wrong time of day, to offer an extra offering that wasn't required or even expected or asked for, possibly to even decide to go into the Holy of Holies. Since they were special, they could do it. And God struck them down dead before they entered there, because only the high priest was allowed to go there, and only on one day of the year, the Day of Atonement. More likely, it looks like they used coals from another fire, which was possibly more ready, hotter, closer, who knows? But they used something from a fire that God had not wanted them to do it. Now, God could have told us specifically what the infraction was, but God, obviously, by not mentioning that, wanted us to get the big picture of they didn't do what they were told. Because if not, then people wouldn't get the big message. So we're supposed to get the big picture and do what God tells us to do, and not do what something as far as at least the services, what he tells us not to do. In the Daily Bible Study commentary, George Knight says it this way: this action of theirs was no mere peccadillo. It was a flagrant piece of disobedience and disloyalty to God. These men were virtually saying, our fire is as good as yours, God. We don't need yours. This is an acted parable of the way that secular men thinks about his relationship with God at all times. Their action came under the category of sins with a high hand and was so worthy of death. Sins of the high hand, worthy of death. Looks like Mr. Knight has it correctly. Now, mankind would probably praise them for their adaptability or their resourcefulness or bringing extra worship to the holy place. But that's not what God commanded. So he answered their fire with his own fire and struck them down dead. We see religion today, lots of different groups, try and come up with something creative. Hey, let's sing rock and roll and have just a rock and roll, we'll call it a church. God doesn't want creative worship. He wants worship to be what he wants and what he's expected, teaching. That's what he is expecting from us. Nadab and Abihu may have, even just once, forgotten the power and holiness of God. But it was such an offense that God, their father, Aaron, and Uncle Moses were not even able to bring or save them. Now, it might seem harsh to us, but God would not suffer his commandments to be broken with impunity. It just wasn't going to happen. Not from the leadership. Not right from the start. He had just given them these words. And not as soon as he turned around, they were going to break it. God wants to be worshipped in his way, a way of his choosing, not ours. It is interesting to be able to see how contemporary Christianity does something completely different. Even one of our former organizations some time back, they've changed their beliefs entirely. Different prayers, worship dances. It's creative to an almost stunning degree, but it's not what God expected. God's ways are not our ways. but we shouldn't be doing our ways. Then in verse 6 and 7, God says something else that seems strange initially to us and shows us once again that God's ways are not our ways. Verse 6, once again, Leviticus 10, and Moses said to Aaron and Eleazar and Ithamar, his sons, do not uncover your heads nor tear your clothes, lest you die and wrath come upon all the people. But let your brethren, the whole house of Israel, bewail the burning which the Lord had kindled. You shall not go out from the door of the tabernacle of meeting, lest you die, for the anointing oil of the Lord is upon you. In this case, God says not to mourn the deaths of Nadab and Abihu. What? Not to mourn? For Aaron, his two sons have just been struck down dead. He's told not to mourn. Their brothers have just been struck down. Any grief, in this case, would have indicated dissatisfaction with God's judgment. In addition, verse 7 shows that they were to keep working and do the work of God in the tabernacle. Now, it wouldn't normally seem right to us, but God's ways are not ours. As priests, these men, next in line after Aaron, had a spiritual responsibility to care for the congregation of Israel. And such disregard for God's law, if they avoided it, would have led to further degradation and eventually the death of hundreds of thousands. But because when the priesthood or the ministry fails or falls into sin, the congregation suffers the wrath of God. So they were expected to go on. And as the charred bodies of two of the most important men in the congregation were taken through the people of Israel and outside the camp, it must have caused quite a stir. A couple men being carried by their singed clothes, struck probably with something that looks like a lightning bolt. People that everyone would have known, it would have been shocking. It would have brought a tremendous sense of awe and just, what did they do? How serious is this? It would have woken people up. And it also would have showed that God's not a respecter of persons, and he has high expectations of his leaders. As one commentator says, God has never left it up to humans to decide how to obey him, but only if they will obey him. It's not up to us to decide how, only if. And Nadab and Abihu and the rest of the priesthood surely learned this lesson in a powerful and dramatic way that day. And one final takeaway from this section is in the verse following, verses 8 and 9. Verse 8, then the Lord spoke to Aaron, saying, do not drink wine or intoxicating drink, you nor the sons with you, when you go into the tabernacle of meeting, lest you die. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations, that you may distinguish, once again, distinguish between the holy and the unholy, between unclean and clean, and that you may teach the children of Israel all the statutes which the Lord has spoken to them by the hand of Moses. God tells Aaron and the rest of the priesthood to remember that they had a tremendous calling and to not let their senses be dulled to the responsibility of teaching and setting a proper example. Now it nowhere says that Nadab and Abihu were drinking prior to their deadly sin. It doesn't say that. But the proximity of the command to their deaths has prompted, justifiably, probably, many commentators to surmise that Nadab and Abihu had been drinking. It had been a celebration. It had been a consecration several days long. Perhaps they were drunk. Maybe not. Drunk, perhaps they just had enough to lose focus on what they were doing. To forget what was holy and forget what was profane. What was acceptable to God as opposed to right in the eyes of men. And from this time forward, you can bet that the priests, being warned by this death or these deaths, approach God and his holy place with reverence and with a godly fear, before which they may not have. If you'll turn over to Isaiah 28, verse 7. Isaiah 28, verse 7. We'll look again what some of the other issues that we've had down through the ages with some of the people who should know better, some of the religious leaders through the children of Israel. Isaiah 28 and verse 7. But they have erred through wine and through intoxicating drink and are out of the way. The priesthood, the prophet, have erred through intoxicating drink. They are swallowed up by wine. They are out of the way through intoxicating drink. They err in vision. They stumble in judgment. Sad things to be able to see after what happened to Nadab and Abihu, that once again this was a problem. That the priest had a problem with alcohol, the right use of it, and how are they able to teach others if they're not doing it themselves. Now if we turn to the New Testament in Titus 1, we know what Titus is talking about. Titus in this section is one of the sections talking about the ministry, the qualities of an elder. And what does it say in verse 9? Breaking into the subject about the qualities of the elder. We'll start in verse 8. It says, be hospitable, a lover of what is good, sober-minded, just, wholly self-controlled, holding fast the faithful word as he has been taught, that he may be able by sound doctrine to exhort and convict those who contradict. Back in verse 7, it talks, not given to wine. Not given to wine. So, once again, this is a quality of the elder. Make sure. And that's why we have a long-standing tradition in the church that those that are speaking, the ministry, others that are teaching, we don't drink. No one drinks before giving a message. That's just not to be done. So how does this play for us? Well, just a few short weeks from now, we're going to be going to the feast. And sure, we're supposed to enjoy the good things. Good food, good drink are mentioned in particular. But we should always remember that even as we enjoy the harvest, the blessings that God has given, we should not let our senses be dulled either. Remember that our highest priority at the feast is to learn more about God and His way and how to become more like Him. The New Testament mentions several times either Israel or God's people being dulled in heart or in hearing. We are warned to keep our senses sharpened to make sure that we do not lose focus, or any focus, on what is holy and what is unholy. Turn over to Hebrews 5, verse 11. Hebrews 5, verse 11. It talks about, for though you, by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you again the first principles of the oracles of God, and you've come to need milk, not solid food. For everyone who partakes only of milk is unskilled in the word of righteousness, for he is a babe. But solid food belongs to those who are full age. That is, by reason of use, they had their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. So their senses are not dulled, their senses are sharp. That's the way we should be. We should have our senses sharpened so that we're able to exercise our minds so that we can discern good and evil. It's very important because we have a job. God's given us an opportunity, a blessing that we all are very familiar with. 1 Peter 2, verse 9. 1 Peter 2, 9. Final scripture here. 1 Peter 2, 9. But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of the darkness and into the marvelous light. We're a special priesthood. We have to learn the examples, the failings, the mistakes, and also the positives of the previous priesthood. What happened to Nadab and Abihu? Make sure that doesn't happen in our lives. Make sure that we, brethren, as future kings and priests, we can learn a lot from those examples of Nadab and Abihu. We're reminded to whom much is given, much is expected. That we are to discern and be boundary setters. We're reminded that man's ways are not God's ways. And finally, to not let our senses be dulled to God's teaching and God's instruction. So with these reminders, I hope the next few weeks, as we prepare for the feast, as well as the entire feast season, can be more profitable for all of us.